Hi friends, it is World Breastfeeding Week, and this formula feeding mom supports whatever your feeding journey looks like. Breastfeeding, chest feeding, formula feeding, exclusively pumping, giving your child donor milk, whatever your journey is, let's just feed the babies, right? But I wanted to re-air an episode today that was a really popular one, but it's now way back, episode 58. We're in the 170s now, and it is with a leading expert on breastfeeding and chest feeding, Laura Wilson. So I'm pulling it out of the archives to play it for you now because it is jam-packed full of so much wisdom around feeding our babies, but even just giving oxytocin to our babies for those of us who, like myself, have struggled with nursing. So it's got a lot of great information, and I think there are a lot of great takeaways for anyone interested in this topic. Before I hit play for you, I wanted to mention that just recently I launched the Plus Size Pregnancy Weekly Breakdown. It has been a labor of love for me this year to put together, along with it being peer reviewed, and I'm so grateful that people who donated their time. Over 800 images were donated for this project, so you'd really see what plus size pregnancy looks like on bodies of all sizes, shapes, and colors. It is absolutely beautiful. It is completely free for you to dig into over on plussizebirth.com. Because like Ollie's, I'm just creating the resources I searched for when I was plus size and pregnant, and I didn't find weekly information that really made me feel like, oh, like I'm feeling supported in this way because of my size. I more so wondered, I'm reading and everyone's feeling, you know, little flutters and kicks, you know, around 17 weeks and I'm not feeling anything. Am I not normal? So I just really hope that this weekly breakdown helps to normalize what it can be like to be plus size and pregnant. Okay, I'll stop rambling. I'm just really proud of it. Head on over to plussizebirth.com to check it out. And now let's get to the show. Hi, friends, and welcome to the Plus Mommy Podcast. I'm your host, Jen McClellan, and here we explore plus size pregnancy, motherhood, and body love. From bumps to bellies, we talk about it all. Now let's get started. Hello, friends. This is the episode that you have been asking for and waiting for, but I didn't roll it out until now because I've been waiting for my friend, Laura Wilson. She's an IBCLC author, speaker, and just an incredible expert in breastfeeding. And I wanted to tackle this topic, but I wanted to do it with someone that I truly, truly respect and admire. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. And I'm excited for this conversation.
Thank you. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your experience with supporting people with breastfeeding and your expertise?
Yeah, so I've been in this field for about 25 years, and I originally entered the field as a new mom, finding that I really struggled with my own birthing experiences and my breastfeeding experiences, and I didn't want other families to struggle the way that I did. So I entered into the field first as a doula, then a childbirth educator, and then I started to really fall in love with the lactation world. And that has been my significant focus for about the past 17 years.
Wow.
And I love everything breastfeeding. I love the science behind it. I love the families behind it. I mean, I love all aspects of lactation. So I'm excited to bring some of that information that I've gained over the past couple decades to all of your fans.
Thank you. I feel it's so beautiful. We come into this work around birth and postpartum, either with these stories that champion us and make us want to help other, or these stories of struggle that make us want to help others. But I think that's what makes us so incredibly passionate about this work. And it's beautiful because we've come to it from two different places, but have the same level of just desire of impacting lives for the better.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think too, that when you come to this work of supporting families in a variety of different ways, because you have had an individual experience, it also brings a great deal of empathy to the work and allows you to understand the challenges that families have in a very different way than if it's just part of your job.
Yes, completely, yeah. Completely. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of challenges, I just thought breastfeeding would be the easiest thing in the whole world because my mother breastfed me till 2.5 and always talked about breastfeeding and birth. And so I remember saving breastfeeding for like the last piece of education. I focused so much around labor and birth that I had this breastfeeding book on my nightstand when I went into labor a month early. And then I gave birth to this tiny baby that had some struggles. And I still thought in the beginning, oh, even when he was in the NICU, like my boobs are so big, I could feed the whole NICU. Like I just remember having this idea that breastfeeding was going to be easy. And then it wasn't. And it became devastating and so hard and such a struggle. And it is still to this day, like when I look back on my birth and postpartum, one of the biggest regrets now in this work that I do and all that I know now, and I know we shouldn't look back and beat ourselves up, but we're moms, so we do it and we're humans, but was that I didn't connect with an IBCLC specifically, not just the lactation consultant, but an IBCLC to get true support around the needs of not only myself, but my son to support us in whatever breastfeeding could look like for us. So can you please, Laurel, explain what an IBCLC is?
Yeah. So an IBCLC stands for International Board Certified Lactation Consultant. And the training that's involved to become an IBCLC, you have to take a 90-hour specific lactation course. You have to get anywhere from 500 to 1,000 clinical hours under your belt that meets all of these specific criteria within the curriculum. And you also have to sit for a very lengthy international exam. And the focus of the training for IBCLCs is not only counseling and serving families who are lactating, but understanding that there is a clinical aspect to supporting families when things are not going ideally. So many IBCLCs have a clinical practice that helps families who specifically have found that something is outside the realm of normal.
Yeah.
Whereas many of our other amazing lactation professionals do some incredible peer support and other types of support within the community and are very needed and certainly fill important roles within the community. The IBCLC is specifically designed for that clinical look at here's what's going on and here are all of the options that we can try to hopefully solve those problems. But I do want to go back to how you said it was the last thing that you addressed. And I think it's because we think about it in a timeline. Mm-hmm. First, we think about fertility and educating ourselves on fertility. And then we think about then pregnancy is next and, you know, and then birth and then breastfeeding. But the reality is that, you know, your birth experience, you know, will last 12 to 36 hours on average, but your breastfeeding relationship can last years,
yeah.
You know, 5 or 6 years for some people. And yet we spend such a small amount of our prenatal education on that relationship. So it's something that we really want to shift and change in order to address some of these bigger issues that families have.
Yes, I love that. It's so true. As you were saying that, I kind of got chills like, oh, she's so right. Like we spend so much time. It's kind of like preparing for a wedding and not the marriage type thing, you
right.
know? Yeah.
Well, which that happens all the time too, right?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I wanted to ask you specifically about IBCLCs. And I love how you said that there are many different ways to get support around breastfeeding. And I totally agree. And we can talk about those too. But there are studies to show that people of size have lower incidences of continuous breastfeeding. And also, we know that an IBCLC can actually increase breastfeeding outcomes for people of size. So it's just really important that we talk about the fact that there are so many, and there's nothing more supportive than being in like a local breastfeeding group and in a room full of people nursing and celebrating breastfeeding and feeling supported in breastfeeding. I can't speak highly enough and encourage that if this is part of your journey. But
But if you are struggling and if there are hurdles you need to overcome, then I really encourage you to connect with an IBCLC. And if you're pregnant right now, setting aside a little bit of money for an IBCLC is so important, because I never could have anticipated the expense of formula. I mean, we tried everything we could. We pumped, and I pumped while nursing. I took all the fenugreek. Like, I tried all the things online and spent money on all the things, but I didn't spend a little bit of money on an IBCLC. And we were able to never exclusively breastfeed, but nurse for about 4 months. And it was hell. It was awful, because Brayden, my son, he just liked the bottle. It flowed so easily. So he would just pull away from me and I would get IBS and I'd have to like run to the bathroom. And it was just such a form of stress. And I don't think it needed to be that way. And then my husband finally at, you know, around 4 months was just like, you know, or maybe I think it's 5 months, was just like, you can stop. And that was crushing, because I didn't want to, but I needed permission to. And I feel like so many people who I've talked to have stories somewhat similar, especially people of size. And I think part of it is that we're not getting the support we need around breastfeeding and the education to know that it is going to take longer for our milk to come in. And we just sometimes need extra support, and especially those with PCOS. And I want to get into that a little bit later. But what mm-hmm. recommendations, Laurel, do you have for someone who, I don't even think it matters size, but someone who is pregnant and wants to breastfeed? What are your recommendations? What is your guidance?
Yeah. So my first recommendation is, of course, to find a really good breastfeeding class. And ideally, you want it to be a class that's at least 3 hours long. You know, these fly-by-night 45-minute classes just are not going to do it. You cannot learn what you need to know in 45 minutes. And then I also recommend reading a couple really good breastfeeding books. Ina May's Guide to Breastfeeding is one of my favorites, as well as Breastfeeding Made Simple. They're really foundational books for families to embrace what that relationship is going to look like. And then the other thing that I recommend prenatally is to make sure that an individual will get their basic hormone levels tested.
Oh, wow.
Just so that they know they have a baseline, they know what their thyroid function is doing. You know, they have a good idea of what that looks like for them. And that way, if in the postpartum period, there seems to be some hormonal challenges around lactation, we can look back at earlier labs and do some comparisons. Because often what we find, particularly for individuals of size, is that there may be a hormonal challenge. And it's really important for us to be able to kind of piece that together and look at it historically to see how do we address these issues so that we can maximize milk output for families. You know, and we're seeing so many ways that we can work with families through both diet and addressing stress levels and exercise levels and sleep. There's just so many things that we can do, but it's good for us to know, what are your hormones actually doing? Because breastfeeding ultimately is a hormonal relationship.
And that makes so much sense of why. Yeah, for us, it was such a struggle having a tiny baby, and both of our hormones were probably going in opposite directions. But so yeah. Talk a little bit, this fascinating, of how hormones play a role in breastfeeding a little bit more.
Yeah. So during pregnancy, the pregnancy hormone progesterone and estrogen, what they're doing is they are developing breast tissue. So they are preparing from about 16 weeks into pregnancy. The body says, hey, there's going to be a little one that we need to feed outside this body. And so those hormones go to work to creating mammary tissue. So often around 16 weeks, the pregnant parent will start to recognize that their breasts start to feel a little heavier, a little denser. They may start to feel pretty tender. And that's because there's a lot of development going on. It's really similar to that stage in your cycle when all of a sudden you have the breast tenderness and the breasts seem to swell. That's kind of an anticipation of, oh, we're going to be cycling soon. We may have an opportunity to have a baby in our life, kind of thing. And this is the same thing that's going on during pregnancy, only there is that validation hormonally that there is a baby that needs to be fed. Mm. And so those hormones do most of the work helping support that development of the breast. And then we're also starting to see a rise in prolactin levels towards the end of pregnancy. And what prolactin is, that is our magic hormone that makes milk.
Wow.
And it stays really, really highly elevated through the first weeks postpartum. And then it drops. And we only see it kind of rise with each breastfeed. And the other hormone that starts to really rise and plays a really big role is oxytocin.
The love hormone.
Oxytocin is amazing. And some of your listeners may know that we call oxytocin our love hormone. Like, it's our bonding hormone. It's a hormone that helps us fall in love and stay connected. And we release it at primary bonding moments. Like, when you fall in love, you have that pheromone release. We actually release oxytocin, and it creates your eyes to dilate and make that visual connection and create that first bond. And then every time you have an orgasm with that person, that's oxytocin happening, creating more of a bond. Throughout pregnancy, you have heightened levels of oxytocin helping you to bond with your baby in utero. And then as we go through birth, oxytocin is responsible for the contractions that are occurring, mm-hmm. but it also elevates that oxytocin level in the baby. And in fact, the highest levels of oxytocin the human being will ever experience is during the pushing phase of labor. Wow. Both the mother and the baby will have this incredibly heightened amount of oxytocin, and that precedes the delivery to allow for this space of optimal bonding right at birth. And then that just continues. You know, once the baby is born, hopefully, ideally, it's placed skin to skin. And that just creates this kind of magical dance for all the hormones. Skin to skin allows oxytocin to be released, which helps contract the milk cells and get milk out. And it also helps stimulate more prolactin, which is the milk-making hormone. But what also happens at delivery is generally, you know, estrogen and progesterone, those two pregnancy hormones, drop. But what sometimes happens for people who may have some insulin sensitivity issues is they may continue to have heightened levels of estrogen throughout their postpartum experience. And this can sometimes hinder the production of milk.
Wow.
And so this can sometimes then be one of those issues that we'll have to address directly in a hormonal way to help with some milk supply.
So what issues. I'm hearing is people with gestational diabetes or diabetes, you definitely want to get that extra support if breastfeeding is part of their plan.
Absolutely. Or people who have PCOS.
Yes.
With PCOS, we also see that sometimes we have a really estrogen dominant situation. And so it again is just something that you'll want to identify. And many, many people already know if they are in a situation with PCOS. But what's really interesting is oftentimes people may not know they have any hormonal issues until late pregnancy or after they give birth to a baby, because their body has been able to mask symptomology for years, you know, or we've just managed it, or we've just learned to work around it. And then all of a sudden, when you have those pregnancy hormones trying to run the show, it can create such a diversion in kind of that baseline health that all of a sudden then people start to be diagnosed with things like PCOS or insulin resistance. So
My mind is just like, poosh, like you are just so smart and you're so amazing, Laurel. I absolutely love you. Like, I could take this conversation to like 4,200 ways. Let's talk a little bit more about PCOS and breastfeeding, as that, again, is something that people have wanted me to bring up on the show. It's something that, a lot of people in my community have struggled with and don't get the support they need around it. So if someone is going into pregnancy with PCOS, where along their journey to postpartum, do they need that help? And what is, so it's the hormones really, as you said, that is impacting breastfeeding or with PCOS.
Yes. Generally, it's generally the hormones. So, you know, what happens with, and PCOS is a syndrome, it's not a disease. So it's often kind of the outcome of a variety of different hormonal situations that go on.
Yeah. And I should mention that if people don't know what it is, it's polycystic ovarian syndrome. So, and right. If you know what it is, then you know what we're talking about. If you don't, then it can manifest with weight gain, even though people are like, oh, you're big, you have PCOS. And like, no, like weight gain can be a byproduct. Yeah. Anyways, weight gain, facial hair and hair, body hair, but yet loss of hair on your head. I mean, it just manifests in so many different ways. And for many people, women have said that it's like the robbery of womanhood. And that just, that breaks my heart, but it can really impact fertility as well. So if you yes. have any concerns about, you know, any of those signs, I'll definitely put resources in the show notes. Talk to a care provider and don't just allow someone to blow you off. Like, find someone who will really work with you, because it's so important that you get support and help around it as well. So back to breastfeeding and PCOS.
Yes. So one of the things that happens with PCOS sometimes is that it increases the androgen hormones. And what that does is it kind of puts, it like kind of holds up a stop sign to oxytocin and prolactin. So it tells oxytocin, which is the contracting hormone, the milk letdown hormone, and prolactin, which is milk making hormone, to kind of slow down production. And that's definitely not what you need.
Yeah.
When you're to feed a baby early on. And the other thing that can sometimes happen through both early on in development, like during the teen years when the first stage of breast development occurs, or during pregnancy when the second really massive stage of breast development occurs, is if PCOS is a syndrome that that person is dealing with, we can see that there are too few prolactin receptors in the mammary tissue to begin with.
Wow.
So it's just part of, you know, if the breasts don't develop appropriately, there may just not be a great amount of tissue for a full milk supply. That doesn't mean breastfeeding cannot occur. It just means that we'll need to define what a new level of relationship breastfeeding will be between that parent and that baby. And then the other thing is the estrogen dominance can also occur. And estrogen also kind of puts the brake on the lactation hormones as well. So we see about a third of all parents who have PCOS have some significant breastfeeding challenges. Only a third, though.
Yeah.
Out of that third, a third of that, so 1/9 of all people who have PCOS struggle to make any milk supply at all. And what's interesting, within that third, you've got the people who struggle to make any milk, you have the people who struggle to make a good amount of milk, and then you have people who struggle with oversupply, which can be just as much of a challenge yes. as supply. And so I'm going to stop right there and see if you have any questions before I move forward with kind of like things that we do to help.
Wow. No, I'm just so thankful to hear this, because I mean, I definitely also want to talk about specifically challenges that people of size face. But I just think there's assumption that, oh, because I have PCOS, I can't breastfeed. But I love how you said that, you know, nursing can be in so many different ways. And I knew that with Brayden. Like I said earlier that it was hell, but there were some magical moments. And I'm proud of all I did to make sure that he did have some of my milk as long as I could provide it to him. So just a reminder that nursing can be in so many different ways and forms. So tell us more. Dive back in.
Yes. So and to really expand on that a little bit, there are so many layers to that relationship. We have some people who exclusively provide donor milk or artificial milk to a baby through a variety of different forms, either through like a supplemental nursing system, or, you know, they may even cup feed or bottle feed, but then they have their baby do suckle care, which is what is sometimes called non-nutritive nursing, which I don't care for
yeah,
that term.
No.
It sounds very, I don't know, disheartening. But suckle care is essentially that the baby will latch on and suckle, and, you know, the mom gets all of those beneficial hormones released, and the baby gets all those beneficial hormones released. So it's still supporting that relationship to all of the different other elements that we can see where a parent is using that supplemental nursing system and sometimes putting in whatever supplement she is using and feeding the baby, or, you know, has full milk supply. So there's a wide variety of what can happen and what can be considered absolutely normal and healthy for that family.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yes. And I also think that any and all milk is great, as well as any and all, you know, suckling is great.
Mm-hmm. So, yes.
You know, don't define your breastfeeding relationship by amounts. That's not what we should impose in the lactation world. It's all good. Every drop, every suckle, it's all good.
Oh, Laurel, say that again. Say it. Don't. No, please say it again. I need to hear it. I need to hear it.
Okay. I'm not even sure exactly what I said, but basically I said that we need to not define the relationship with breastfeeding in terms of amounts or time, that every drop is good and every suckle is good. It's all wonderful. So we need to remember that and embrace that concept. You know, and especially as a clinician, we sometimes get tied into amounts and timing and all that, which, you know, we know we're not supposed to as clinicians, as IBCLCs, but it's easy to fall into that pattern. And what we ultimately need to do is find what the best path options are for that family, and they get to choose what's best for them. So,
oh, that was so healing to hear. So I hope that everyone listening, if you're a mom already and you've had your struggles, like, rewind that and play that back, because you do. And I feel like there's so much, and we could talk about like the societal stigmas around breastfeeding and why breastfeeding is important, but I feel like all of that is covered in so many different ways. And I just really wanted to focus more on, you know, how just resourceful ways and tips and knowledge around breastfeeding when you are a person of size or have PCOS. But, you know, there's so much pressure and there's so much that we just need to hear things like that to say that, you know, you're doing what you can and the best you can. And hopefully by listening to this episode too, you'll learn more resources. And like, I had never heard to get your hormone levels checked during pregnancy. I mean, that is brilliant. That in of itself can play out in multiple ways for someone's health, not only with breastfeeding. So I just think that's genius. So thank you so much for what you, my heart is swelling right now. Thank you, Laurel. Aww. I mean, really, thank you. So you were going to touch a little bit more on PCOS and signs and that you were going to, yeah.
Yeah. So a big thing that you can do that seems to have a lot of really positive result is address nutrition, because what often happens during pregnancy for those who have PCOS is intense sugar cravings. And that's just because of the way the body is using insulin to make a new person.
Yeah.
And so the body's like, oh, you know, really craving that sugar because of the changes in insulin levels. But it becomes really important not to eat foods that are, you know, true, just sugary foods, moving into kind of like vegetables and fruits that have natural sweetness, like focusing on things like yams and beets and brown rice and things. Oh gosh, what else would be another example? Or, you know, actual fruits like raspberries are amazing because they help address that sweetness craving, but they give you some really amazing nutrients that actually help stabilize the insulin levels. And there's a really great book called The New Glucose Revolution, a guide to, let me make sure I wrote it down so I have it's a long title, The New Glucose Revolution, Guide to Managing PCOS. And there are so many great tips for how you can really optimize your nutrition, both during pregnancy and lactation, really anytime with PCOS. And it's a really, you know, that's the easiest intervention.
Yeah.
Is to make really healthy choices with food that nourish you, nourish your baby, and are going to nourish and sustain your breastfeeding relationship. And the other thing is sometimes herbs will be recommended. This is one of the reasons why we like to get an IBCLC involved, and or a naturopath and or a nutritionist, mm-hmm. because there are all these pieces that are so unique to the individual, and it's good to have a hormonal panel. It's good to have someone who knows their stuff in terms of nutrition. And it's good to have someone who knows how to put all of that together in kind of a clinical, practical way for families. Because sometimes things like goat's rue, which is an herb, a natural herb, and it's something that's used in the dairy industry a lot to help develop mammary tissues for both goats and cows. That's what gives it its name, goat's rue. So it's sometimes used for people who didn't develop sufficient mammary tissue in their teen years or even throughout pregnancy. So wow. It just continue that development of tissue. But then there's also a drug called metformin, mm-hmm. which is based off of goat's rue, and that is safe for breastfeeding, and it can be really effective for people who have PCOS to help during lactation. The challenge is the side effects, not so good. It can cause diarrhea, and irritable bowel syndrome. So a lot of people go off metformin pretty
quickly. Yeah, I had it prescribed once. Yeah, I was working with this doctor. My blood sugars were normal. She's like, I think this would help you. I don't know why, because I'm fat. Apparently, she wanted to give it to me. It was like running to the bathroom. Please let me make it. This is, but I mean, I've heard from other people that it can definitely help with fertility, and it's good to know that it can help with breastfeeding too. So I know there's, you can, it can help be helpful if you eat at certain times and really to manage it and not go all in with a massive dose. So I'm sure there's a lot of people shaking their heads up and down like, oh yeah, I know all about metformin. But I love that book that you recommended. I'll definitely put it in the show notes. And, you know, I talk on the show a lot about how nutrition during pregnancy and even postpartum and for the rest of our lives, you know, but especially during pregnancy, it's this time to change our relationship with food. And we've been conditioned to diet, which is actually really harmful for our bodies. And you don't want to be really restrictive, especially during pregnancy and especially breastfeeding. I mean, I know part of my problem was I definitely was dehydrated because I was so stressed out and I wasn't getting the water I needed. I mean, there's just so many things that go into play. And I think maybe for some people listening, this might feel like overwhelming, like, oh, I need an IBCLC and a nutritionist and I need that and I need that. But I think if we look back on like the history of people giving birth, like we were a community. We were in this community where everyone was coming together and supporting one another. So you had the midwife and you had, you know, all these people that were there to support you along this journey. And that was just normal. And we've so lost that in our culture. So all that Laurel and I are really recommending is to build back in that support team. And sometimes you have the most well-intentioned mother or mother-in-law, but I know personally, sorry, mom, if you're listening, that it was actually really hard to have someone that was just like, oh, well, it was so easy for me, but oh, watch how you're holding your breast because I, you know, Brayden needs to be able to breathe. And so I think sometimes things are said that are well-meaning, but can really hurt our hearts and be hard. So having that team of kind of experts to be like, no, you're doing a great job. Let's just try this a little bit different. It can really help to improve not only maybe your breastfeeding experience or postpartum experience, but also your mental health around this whole journey during parenthood.
Definitely. And the beauty too, is that nowadays most IBCLCs have this whole, they may actually be registered nutritionists themselves, you know, and, but if they aren't, they know who to refer you to. And it's the same thing with your midwives. I mean, a lot of midwives are IBCLCs as well, and they may also be nutritionists or have those connections. So sometimes you're going to find that all of those people you want to connect with is the one person standing in front of you. And if not, they should be able to refer you to a team that will be specifically helpful, because, you know, like you mentioned with metformin, that for some people, that's not the best option. The herb goes through might be the best option and provide the fewest side effects for them. And there's also something that's called myo-inositol, and that is just a chemical that's found naturally in foods like nuts and seeds and beans. And that can also be a really helpful stabilizer for insulin levels as well. And that you can find it in supplements, but you can also just add those foods to your diet, which can be a really easy and non-interventive way to kind of help with those insulin challenges as well. There's also a plant called moringa, which is known to be lactogenic, which is known to help with milk supply, and that seems to work really well with goats through. But again, I would never make a recommendation just across the board. Yeah. You'd want to be working with someone individual to find out, is this an herb that's actually going to work for my particular situation? Because if you don't have insufficient, you know, glandular tissue, like you don't have, then goat through is not going to really help you because that's what it's for. So you need to find the herb that treats the scenario that you're dealing with. Low estrogen, high estrogen, low prostaglandin, you know, high prostaglandin, whatever that is, you want to find the herb that's going to address that issue.
But what I'm hearing is that there are resources out there, which is so helpful. And so that's what I want people to take away. I don't want you Googling all the things that Laurel had said. I want you to Google IBCLC, comma, whatever town you live in. That's what we're sharing. I'm just popping in to say that I've been where you might be today. Plus size, pregnant, and discouraged by all the negative information online about what it is like to have a plus size pregnancy. Over the past 7 years, as a certified childbirth educator, I've supported thousands of plus size people during pregnancy, and I've poured all the information I've gained into a guide that will support you. Get the My Plus Size Pregnancy Guide today at plussizebirth.com. Be sure to enter coupon code PLUSMOMMY to get 20% off your guide. You can also get the audiobook version that I recorded just for you. Stop Googling and start feeling empowered today. Now, let's get back to the show. So let's go back to plus size person who has just given birth. Do you know, Laurel, why it can take longer for our milk supply to come in?
Yes. So what we see is a delay in the stage of lactation sometimes. And that is due to, we have this thing called the triad of lactation. And it involves cortisol, insulin, and prolactin. So you need these three things to be in balance to see that stage two of milk happens in a really timely manner. But what sometimes happens for people of size is that they may have higher cortisol levels, or they may also have some issues with insulin stability. And so when those are not in complete balance with prolactin, it can simply take a little bit more time for that second stage to occur. It almost always occurs unless there's some other significant hormonal issues, like if you're in that 1/9 of the population for PCOS. But for most people, it will. It's just a little bit delayed. And so I think it's important that we reiterate to these families, just keep going. And the best thing we can do is have them be skin to skin with their baby. Mm-hmm. Because the more that they're skin to skin with their baby, the more that we are lighting up the prolactin receptors, which are the parts of the breast tissue that receive prolactin to make milk. So every time you do skin to skin, every time you feed your baby, every time your partner massages you, every time you have loving touch with another person in that postpartum period, you are amplifying your opportunity to make milk. So the best thing to do in that early postpartum period is really hold your baby skin to skin. And I love to tell, you know, a lot of families love those, you know, like their pregnancy tank tops. I love them too, because after the baby's born, you can tuck the baby in the tank top and the baby's there skin to skin, and people can come and visit you and you don't feel like you're, you know, kind of have your breasts out and everything. You're just there holding your baby and increasing your opportunity for your milk to come in a little bit earlier. And the key is the other thing that I want to really make sure that parents understand is that they do have milk. They have colostrum. The colostrum's just in small volume. It's still really important for the baby, and it will stay throughout that entire stage until the milk transitions to higher amounts. But you still have colostrum. It just means the baby may want to feed more frequently. It doesn't mean you don't have milk. It means you have a specific kind of milk. And that colostrum will maintain itself until the milk transitions. And again, usually it transitions between 28 to 48, 72 hours. But sometimes for people of size, we may see another 24 to 48 hour delay.
So what is your advice for someone who has just given birth? They're feeling like, you know, I don't have milk come in, I have colostrum. Should I be supplementing immediately? Because I can feel people thinking like, if it's going to come in later, then am I going to have to supplement, or what should I do? Is my baby getting what they need? You know, all the new mom fears and insecurities, mm-hmm. I can sense are being thought about.
So there's a wide variety of options. And again, it's not just a one solution situation. What some parents are encouraged to do is to do prenatal expression of the breast and store their milk. Because sometimes you can get, you know, even a few drops of colostrum through that time you can store. That can be additional nutrition for the baby if supplementation has to happen. And that's from your body. Some people really like that idea. For some people, it can feel like overwhelming and too much to do, and you're getting small amounts, most people, and so it can seem like, oh, I'm not even making milk, but you are. It's colostrum. It's a small amount. So prenatal expression can sometimes be handy, but again, under the direction of an IBCLC. And then after delivery, oh, the other thing prenatally is you may want to connect with a donor milk bank.
Yeah.
And go ahead and have some donor milk available to you that you have purchased from a milk bank that you can take into your facility if your hospital does not already have donor milk. And so you want to navigate that ahead of time, because if it's really important to you that your baby receives just human milk, you want to find out what the situation at your hospital is. So that's another option. And then another option is peer-to-peer milk sharing. This is becoming much more popular, finding a donor for your milk that you trust. And there's something that you can look up called the 5 pillars of milk sharing. And it helps you to get the safest possible outcome when doing peer-to-peer milk sharing. But that can be another really important option for parents to know about who may have less than optimal supply.
Yeah. And just, you know, to normalize that, I did that. I was pregnant at the other time of a friend that I had known for a very long time. And because I had struggled so much to breastfeed, once I had stopped supplementing with breastfeeding and we were fully on formula, Brayden got really sick once. And I knew the benefits of breast milk. And I asked my friend if I knew she had tons stored, and she was more than happy to share. So I've done it. You know, a lot of people have done it, and I know there's the stigma around it, but like Laurel said, there's a resource to make sure that you're kind of looking at all the safety reasons. But, you know, donor milk and milk banks are an amazing resource, but sometimes they're very expensive. So there are multiple resources. But I also want to go back and say, just because you are a person of size and just because your milk might take longer to come in, it doesn't mean that you can't just exclusively breastfeed and have a smooth transition. We just want to make sure we're sharing, hey, you know, be prepared with some resources, and it might take a little bit longer. So have these tools in your back pocket if you start, you know, having concerns or feeling pressured to start supplementing with formula, if that's not something you want.
Yes, there's so many options on the table. And often, you know, people are given just, you know, one option. Well, your only option is to supplement with formula. Yeah. And that is not the only option on the table. There are so many options. And that's also something that both peer-to-peer support groups like Breastfeeding USA or the Leche League, or even sometimes your hospital breastfeeding support group can help you identify in your community, but also your IBCLC. And the best way to find an IBCLC is ilca.org.
Yes.
A professional organization. They can go on, put their zip code, and find all of them in their area.
Definitely. So I'll have that link in the show notes, and I have it all over my website because I'm like, you get an IBCLC, you get an IBCLC, you get an IBCLC.
I love that. I love it.
So let's talk. So we've talked about, we definitely have focused on PCOS, hormone imbalances. We've talked about that you can take longer for your milk to come in. Let's talk about breastfeeding positions when you are someone of size.
So I think it's whatever works for you. There's no one right position. You know, one of my favorite really is laid back breastfeeding.
Yes.
Now it can, I love it because it's relaxing, which increases the flow of oxytocin, and you feel, it just feels more comfortable to kind of relax and feed your baby, but it also allows your baby to find the best position for the baby. You know, they can be in the sideways position, they can be up and down, they can be in whatever position feels good. But what some people tell me, and this is for any individual, is that sometimes their breasts fall into their like armpits when they lay back in a laid back position. And so there's a couple things that I suggest for parents if when they lay back, their breasts don't stay, you know, pointing up at the ceiling, which pretty much nobody's breasts do.
Yeah, not mine, that's for sure.
So you can wear your tank, which will reduce the amount of direct skin to skin, but that's something you can do and just pull down the side you want to feed on. You can wear a nursing bra and just open access to the breast that the baby is going to be feeding on, but that will keep the breast kind of in a central area. And another thing I do is I have a scarf available. Ooh. So I'll tie a scarf around the mother or the parent's neck, and then it kind of acts as a sling to the breast, and it'll keep the breast kind of in a upright position.
Oh, I love that idea. Or even like an infinity scarf would be really too. Yeah.
Absolutely. And you could also use it as a, you know, I don't know, just a for then when you go into just skin to skin, if you're worried about the temperature of the baby, you can just cover the baby over with the scarf.
Yeah, or have a little bit of privacy if you want it. Yeah, if people are coming in and out. I love it.
So, yeah, football holes can be all right. Even, I mean, any of them work, but I'm a big fan of laid back or reclined positions to try from the beginning. But do whatever works.
Yes.
There's no one right way for any person. And in fact, that may change as the baby gets older. You may have found this position was it, but now the baby's 6 weeks old and will not have it. And the baby wants to be only in this position. So also be open to change as that unfolds.
Yes. So I want you to hear that, because I hear so often from people like, oh, I was told I can only nurse in the football position. And I'm like, what? Like, that doesn't, come on. It's your body, your baby. You guys are going to have your own breastfeeding journey and relationship. And you're going to be nursing in all the ways, including while you're sitting on the toilet going to the bathroom. So just be prepared. That is the reality. And I do want to share that, you know, I really liked breastfeeding pillows. I know a lot of people do. I have a resource of size-friendly pillows that I'll put in the show notes. Also, we've talked a lot about plus-size baby wearing, and Mia from plus-size baby wearing on Instagram has this amazing video on how to nurse when you're plus-size in a carrier that I'll put in the show notes as well. So just realize that you can nurse in all the ways and have all the tools and resources. It's just that things might take a little while, as they do for people of all sizes, to find what works best for you and your baby.
Yes. And I'm a big fan of baby wearing. I'm a huge fan of baby wearing. You know, we have this concept of the golden hour for skin to skin. And originally that concept was to keep the baby skin to skin in the first hour after delivery, because it really promoted milk coming in and the breastfeeding relationship. But that has gotten really misunderstood, because the golden hour was just a basic way to care for a baby in the first hour. But what people started to think it meant was that skin to skin was only for the first hour after a baby was born.
Oh, yeah.
Really, it should be like the golden first year, right? So as much skin to skin as you can get. And even if there's not skin to skin, having your baby in contact with your body, even if it's not directly skin on skin, is really important to your baby's brain development and helps you to keep the baby in the kitchen. So whenever the baby leaves, they're in the kitchen.
Yeah. I'll say, like, even though we had our struggles with breastfeeding, like, we did so much skin to skin, and it was really healing for the both of us, Brayden and I. And I'll tell you, now that he's, you know, 8 years old, still, if I'm wearing like a lower cut tank top or something and he gives me a hug, I don't know, there's something, like, I don't care how old your kids are, something about feeling them, their little face near your chest, like, oh my gosh, like, my heart just starts to flutter, and I feel that oxytocin. Like, we just are forever so bonded with our babies, and so that skin to skin is critically important, and it just makes you feel good.
It is, and it's important for all babies, you know. And they can get it with the parent that gave birth to them. They can get it with their dad, or, you know, their parents' partner, then get it with their grandparents. You know, it's just such an important thing for development, is having skin on skin contact as a young child. And even throughout our lives, we all like to be touched. You know, we all like to feel that connection. So even if breastfeeding is not a choice that someone makes, skin to skin is still a really important part of parenting.
Absolutely. So, Laurel, I know what you're going to say, and I just want to say this to hear you say what I already know you're going to say. Just because breastfeeding is a struggle one time for one postpartum doesn't mean it'll be that way every time, right?
No, absolutely not. And in fact, there's some new research. So one of the things I love to study is something called epigenetics, and it's how your genes activate. And what new research has found is that with every single pregnancy, that your breast tissue remembers the last pregnancy. And so it develops, your breasts develop quicker and they develop more tissue with each and every pregnancy. So there's actually more likelihood with second and third pregnancies that there'll be more tissue available for milk making. That doesn't mean there'll be less breastfeeding challenges, but it means that there's kind of more tissue there. And so definitely not. Don't be discouraged if with your first or even your second pregnancy, there were significant breastfeeding challenges, because it can change and it can really change with the right support.
Yeah. And even your birth, like Brayden was born early. He didn't have the sucking reflex. Like there was so much that played into that, where if I would have had a baby at full term, it could have been completely different. So I just want people to hear that. Don't feel like, oh, I formula baby one, so all my babies are going to have to be on formula. Like, don't necessarily jump to that leap. And, you know, I know we didn't go there, but there are so many benefits to breastfeeding. And I'll definitely have resources in the show notes. But I feel like that's something we get pounded into our heads. And it's but it's true. And it is important. And I don't want anyone to feel ashamed if they struggle, because I really did. And I'm such a proponent of breastfeeding. And people are like, oh, well, you're shaming formula feeding moms. I'm like, no. I was a formula feeding mom. I just really know that we need a lot more support and we're not getting it. And as a society, we're not getting it too. So all the support. And I also have a resource that I'll put in the show notes for those who want to be covered. Like, where can you find size-friendly nursing covers? I have the resource for you. So don't feel. So one other thing, Laurel, because I would love to talk to you all day, but I know you've got a million things to do. You're a very busy woman. When would you say is a good time for someone to get a nursing bra?
Okay. So my recommendation is late in pregnancy, really. I mean, you might, anytime you need a new bra throughout pregnancy, you might as well make it a nursing bra, because there will likely be a point at some point in your later lactation life that your breasts will fit into that bra. So it's fine to, anytime you need a new bra in pregnancy, make it a nursing bra. But my suggestion is later on in pregnancy, towards, you know, your last 6 weeks of pregnancy. And it's hard to determine when that is, right? Because due date means nothing. Sometime around, right? It's like, who made that up? But, and that's because then your breasts have developed. You know, you've started to get a lot of mammary tissue development. And so you're less likely then to, once the baby arrives, to have a bra that doesn't fit you. But the other thing I suggest is fit yourself in a bra and then place your hands inside the cups, because your hands are worth another full cup. And go make sure that your hands fit comfortably. If they're too tight, make sure you try a larger size. And I'm a big fan of flexible fabrics.
Yes.
You know, I don't like those really sturdy bras. And really, I love just those nursing tanks. I would say wait for your, you know, bra that you're going to want to wear under, I don't know, and feel like you're lifted a little bit more until you're about 6 weeks postpartum, because you're also going to get some development in the postpartum period and see a little bit of growth. But here's the other thing. That bra is only going to fit you for a period of time, because eventually the size of your breasts will decline throughout lactation. So it's not going to be a one bra fits all.
Right.
So don't buy 20, buy one or two. And then when you need a new one, buy one or two.
Yeah, I talk about this all the time, but I love the nursing sleep wrap bra, because you, like you were saying early on in the show, like your breasts are tender, you know, during pregnancy. So this was great to wear during pregnancy and postpartum. And it, so that's another great resource. And I'll put more in there. But yeah, I love, like, don't run out like the minute you find out you're pregnant and buy all the things. Like, for most of us, we don't need all the things. And it's amazing how much just a nursing tank top will support you and along your journey. So, well, Laurel, I love you. You are amazing.
I love you.
Share so much that just makes me feel supported and are so knowledgeable. And I love that we dived into topics around breastfeeding that really aren't talked about often enough, and people feel like they don't get the support that they need. So thank you incredibly for the work that you do. Where can people find you?
So they can find me. My website is motherjourney.com. They can find me on Facebook at Mother Journey Laurel Wilson. And then they can also find me on Instagram at Mother Journey Laurel Wilson too. So those are all great places to check in with me. And any questions they have, they're welcome to, you know, email me directly and I'll help find whatever resources they need.
You are incredible. You are also an author. So give yourself a little plug there too.
Sure. So I've written a couple of books and they're really about the experience between mom and baby during the prenatal period, about how to optimize your pregnancy through mindfulness and nutrition and connection and addressing your relationship so you can optimize baby's health. So one's called The Greatest Pregnancy Ever, and it's the same website, thegreatestpregnancyever.com. And then one is called The Attachment Pregnancy, and same website, theattachmentpregnancy.com. So you can find those on Amazon.
They're so good. They're so good. I'll put those in the show notes. Well, Laurel, thank you again. And I know that people are going to walk away from this episode with a whole bunch of tools and resources. And gosh, that I keep holding back on to just getting your hormone levels checked during pregnancy, just asking your doctor for that blood panel as you're getting so many other tests often throughout pregnancy. So that's one of my biggest takeaways from this. So thank you so much for your time and the work that you do. So thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
If you are loving the podcast, then I sure hope you're plugging in over on Instagram at Plus Mommy. There you will see gorgeous images of plus size pregnancy, moments that are inspiring from motherhood, and often me over on Instagram stories in the school pickup lane with no makeup and a messy mom bun talking about life as it is. Come join us over on Instagram over at Plus Mommy so we can connect far more often. See you there soon.